to speak on the first topic that I wrote my first book on a number of years ago, that I always joke may be famous among girls and infamous among their boyfriends, which is the topic of Nigiyah. And I'll tell you how I discovered this topic. Many years ago, to make a long story short, probably you know I was not brought up religious. I was traveling through Europe, ended up in Israel, decided at the very end of my stay there I'd take a few classes for another week. That other week turned into 20-something years, but that's happened sometimes. But on my second day of classes, somebody came over to me and said, hey, have you ever been to a religious wedding? I said, nope. And she said, you want to come? And I said, I'd love to, but you know, I'm not invited or anything. And she said, it's okay, this is Jerusalem. You're allowed to crash people's weddings. Just put on a skirt, we'll take you. And I put on this faded jean skirt, which was the only skirt I owned at the time. And I got taken to my first religious wedding. And I walk in the hall, and right away I see this beautiful bride in this very Victorian-looking wedding gown, which already was a little bit weird, because most wedding gowns today are very, you know, cut out, much more revealing. And as I stared at this woman, there was something radiating from her that was just so unusual. And I didn't know how to describe what it was exactly, but the words that came to mind were like, that she looked so pure and innocent. And you have to understand, at least where I come from, pure and innocent are adjectives that kind of don't attach themselves to girls past like 16. You know? I mean, you know, she's just a 22-year-old woman looking pure and innocent. It was a little bit odd. So I commented on this to the person who brought me to the wedding, and she said to me very cautiously, knowing that I was just a beginner, maybe if she looks pure and innocent, it's kind of because she is. Thank you. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, look, I know that you're new here. I don't know how much you know. I don't know how much you know, but in Judaism, like, we don't have like premarital sexual relationships. So I said, all right, I mean, I kind of figured that, but I mean, she looks really pure and innocent. And then the woman said a little bit more nervously, well, it's kind of not just having had premarital physical relationships. They haven't had like premarital anything. So I looked at her and I said, you want to tell me this lady here is about to get married to some guy and like they've never done anything more serious than hug and kiss and hold hands? And then she kind of dropped the bomb and she said, the truth is they haven't even done that. They haven't even touched. And my mouth dropped open and I'm telling you, if you saw this wedding video, I would be the one in every single frame. Like they're dancing and there's this lady in the corner like this. And, you know, and they're making shepherd buckles and this lady was like, the whole wedding, I was just, my mouth dropped. I was so floored by this. I really couldn't take my eyes off her the whole wedding. How could you do this? But at the same time, I was also really intrigued because I had just recently gotten off of a college campus. I don't know if you have any idea what's going on college campuses. Okay, it's much worse today than it was when I was there. As a matter of fact, I just want to hear a cute little thing that's going on college campuses today. I was at Tufts University a year ago, a week before they had their NQR. Does anybody know what an NQR is? Their naked quad run. 1,000 undergraduates take off all their clothes and go running around the quad. Okay? I'm telling you this in case any of you are ever entertaining any notions about living on campus. Go to camp, go to college fun, live at home, live with a friend. Don't go on a college campus. It's so bad, and that's the least of it. That's like wholesome compared to other stuff that's going on, okay? So anyway, I just came off a college campus. Things were kind of rocking over there at Yale. You know, for a bunch of intellectual nerds, those kids at Yale were having a pretty good time. And I... but what kind of bothered me is that I didn't see normal dating producing spectacular results. And I see it even worse today, and I'm reading books about how bad it is. But like, I saw all these well-intentioned people who kind of ended up in these stupid relationships where they felt either used or just dumb or embarrassed that they were in it, and then it ends, and they move on, and I get into another one. I didn't see long-lasting, spiritually rewarding, you know, loving relationships in most cases. And then here I am in Jerusalem, exposed to this totally abnormal way of dating. And I don't know, I met other young couples at the wedding, they looked happy, they looked cute together, they had dated this way, I met other people who were dating this way, they looked normal, you know, I thought maybe they were all brainwashed, they didn't look brainwashed, I don't know. So I figured I gotta get to the bottom of this. So what I want to share with you today is what was going through my mind when I first encountered this idea, which they told me, was called being Shomer Negiah. When I first encountered this and tried to make sense of it in my own terms. And in my own terms, what I mean is that I didn't believe in God, I didn't believe in Torah, I never even knew the word yeshiva. When they brought me classes, I didn't even know where they were bringing me. I was clueless. So I just asked myself one simple question. Could this possibly make sense? And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to give you my perspective on it, and you can decide for yourselves. So even though nothing I'm saying is so Jewish, I do want to start with one kind of Jewish thing. There's a well-known midrash that says that the first man and woman were created joined back to back like Siamese twins. And then they were separated into a male and a female. What is this midrash trying to tell us? Why did God do this only with humans and not with any other animal? Because deep down in the recesses of our minds, he wanted us to remember that we were once originally whole with somebody else. And now that we're separated, he wants us to have a longing to return to that original oneness. This is why when people find their soulmate, and this term soulmate is kind of problematic actually, but when people find a person they spend the rest of their life with, they have a sense of coming home. They have a sense of like, this is the way it was meant to be, not alone anymore with somebody else. And this is why extended singlehood can be so incredibly painful for the women and men who have to endure it. We're meant to be together, okay? We want to feel close to somebody else. The whole theme of what I want to say today is very, very simple. We are all craving genuine closeness. Most of us in our society today miss the boat on the real thing. And we end up achieving only feeling close. Not being close, but just feeling close. And as you might imagine, there's a huge difference between being close and feeling close. Being close means I have to open myself up, I have to make myself vulnerable, I have to share who I am, and it takes time. You don't just be close to somebody overnight. Feeling close is a far more superficial experience, as wonderful as it feels, and it can be achieved very quickly, almost instantly as a matter of fact. And there's no quicker or easier or more pleasurable way to just feel close to somebody than through touch, physical contact. It's been documented in many sociological studies that touch makes people feel more close, more connected. You know, in Israel, before they did the expulsion from Gaza, which I'm sure you're all aware of all this stuff, they made a human chain from Gaza to Jerusalem. And one of the benefits of that human chain, besides making a political statement that like, we are with you, one of the benefits is like everyone felt so connected on that chain. You're holding hands with people and you know that they're holding hands with somebody else. It was one big thing of like bringing people together, not just politically, but emotionally. Touch is extremely powerful. In Israel, they did some research on the power of touch years ago. They sent someone to use a public phone booth. This is back in the days when the phones were token operated. It sounds hopelessly out of date today, and it is. But they said when you finished your call, leave your unused tokens sitting on the phone as if you forgot them. And then just go off, walk down the street, and just hang out for a couple minutes. So the guy would do this. Somebody else would come along to make a phone call now at this phone booth, and he would see these apparently forgotten tokens left sitting on top of the phone. And he would say, well, got some free tokens today, and he would take them. Now the first person was told, go back to the phone booth and ask for your tokens back. So he'd go back and he'd say, I'm sorry, excuse me for interrupting you, I just made a call from this booth 2 minutes ago, and right after I left, I realized, left all my tokens here. I see they're gone. Did you take them? And if so, they were mine. Could I have them back, please? And they discovered something fascinating, that when the person asked for his tokens back, if he just touched the other guy lightly on the shoulder, that's all, he was much more likely to have his tokens returned to him. Cults know this. Youth groups know this. I recall from traveling alone in Italy and Greece, the Mediterranean men were very aware of the manipulative power of touch. It's powerful stuff. And if it can be this powerful in a non-romantic situation, even more so when the touch is not casual, you know what I'm talking about. And there's actually a scientific explanation for this. For years and years and years, I have been talking about this, based upon intuition, observation, unfortunately, a little bit of personal experience, and only within the past 5 years did I get the scientific backup that made me say, ah, I know what I've been talking about all these years. About 5 years ago, information started breaking on a very fascinating hormone that our bodies produce called oxytocin. Some of you may have heard of it. So, oxytocin is a hormone that is produced particularly when we have physical contact with somebody. For example, when a mother nurses her baby, her body produces a surge of oxytocin. And what's the effect of oxytocin? It makes you feel bonded to the person whom you're having the physical contact with. So a mother will feel bonded with her baby. God put this in our bodies, so we want to take care of our children. When a husband and wife have relations, their bodies produce oxytocin. It bonds them to one another. They feel connected. God wants husbands and wives to stay together. Great. The problem is when the person isn't necessarily your husband, nor is he necessarily planning on becoming it, you're still going to bond. And oxytocin doesn't only make you feel closer to somebody, it actually causes you to drop judgment against them and trust them. It's been called the trust hormone. And there's actually a guy in Florida, I found out, because I met his sister in a lecture once, and I too told his sister to go out and strangle him personally for me. But there's actually a guy in Florida who is marketing a product on the internet called Liquid Trust. Do you know what Liquid Trust is? It's oxytocin distilled in alcohol. And the claim is, and it's a scam, it cannot work, but the claim is that if you spray this stuff on your clothing a few times a day, people in your environment who get a whiff of it will trust you. Now the truth is, you can inhale oxytocin up your nostril, but I think if you're going around sticking a little vial up people's nostrils, it would probably cause some opposite of trust, if you know what I'm saying, okay? But his claim, which the scientists have said is not true, is that just sniffing it in the air around you, you will trust the person in your environment. So the people who are marketing is actually two guys, one of whom, believe it or not, is actually modern Orthodox. I killed this guy. The claim is that, again, people will trust you, and therefore you should wear it to work, because your employer will trust you, and he'll be more likely to give you a raise, or you know, a more responsible position. And of course, they're advocating wearing it on dates. Okay, need I say why? I don't have to be more explicit than that. So a woman wrote into this website, and she said, isn't this manipulative? To which the makers of Trust responded, don't worry, we advocate using Liquid Trust only when it's in both parties' best interest. How do you like this, ladies? You get manipulated into doing something that you shouldn't do with some guy because you've inhaled the Liquid Trust on his body, but it's okay, it's in your best interest. Tell me about it. Okay, I'm furious at these people, absolutely furious. But again, it doesn't really work, so maybe I don't have to be so furious. But this oxytocin stuff is for real. Okay, it's been clinically proven, it's definitely for real. Later on, I'll tell you something that's very frightening about oxytocin and has not yet been proven, but I think it will be proven, unfortunately. But there's one more thing I want to tell you about oxytocin. There's a gender difference in how it works. It works differently in men and women. Have you heard of estrogen and testosterone? So you know that estrogen is the female hormone that women have much more of than men, and vice versa? Estrogen increases the effect of oxytocin. Testosterone diminishes it. Does this not explain an awful lot? What that means is that chemically speaking, when a woman, particularly say a 14-year-old girl, when you're like 13, 14, your hormones are like dancing the hora up there. I mean, they're like out of control, you know what I mean? Out of control. A 14-year-old girl will bond at the drop of a hat. A 14-year-old boy, on the other hand, has such high testosterone levels, 50 to 100 times as high as a girl's, that interfere with the oxytocin response to the point where he's almost incapable of bonding with a girl and is going out for quite a different kind of reason. Now, our hormones level off in time, and please don't anybody say that Gila Manderson said that the boys don't bond with girls. Men are just as capable of a deep bond, of passionately loving a woman, as women are capable of passionately loving a man. But it happens through a different chemical process and a different hormone called vasopressin, and I'm not going to go into all that right now. The fact is that at any point in life, women are going to experience a bond with a guy much more powerfully through touch alone than vice versa. It's just a biological fact, which means that women are more vulnerable. And don't think that guys don't know this, because the smart ones absolutely do. There's a book that came out a few years ago called, I think it's called How to Succeed with Women. And the authors of the book, two men, advise their male readers, guys, you should know, when a woman's going out with you, she's looking at you critically. She's checking you out really thoroughly. She's looking for reasons why you're not good enough for her. Guys, you have to get physical at the first opportunity. Because the minute you get physical with a woman, instead of looking for reasons why you're not the right one, she'll be looking for reasons why you are. And this is unfortunately very true. I ask classes with college students, and maybe I could ask you, I don't really know, you know, who's been where and what friends and stuff that you have. But when I ask classes with college students, they say, how many of you have a girlfriend who you have asked yourself, what is she doing with that guy? Like, doesn't she see who he is? Doesn't she realize what's going on here? And almost every hand goes up. And the answer is no, she doesn't see who she is and she doesn't see what's going on. Because she's dropped judgment and she's trusted, and in a word, she's blinded. So the first thing that happens in the wake of this oxytocin rush that we get from physical contact, which is so pleasurable and feels so good, and by the way, the drug ecstasy gives it to you also. Have you heard of ecstasy? So one of the reasons why it works so good and makes people feel so good is because it causes the body to artificially produce oxytocin, which is actually a very bad thing, as I'll explain later on. Okay? But meanwhile, when you're on this oxytocin high, basically your objectivity goes out the window. You see what you want to see, and you don't see what you don't want to see. I remember, I can tell you a few stories to illustrate this one, but this is when I first became religious. And I went back to America, and I was in New York, and I was visiting a cousin of mine who I'd been hanging out with before I went to Israel. And we got together in this restaurant, and she looked really depressed. And I said, Ellen, what's the matter? And she said, she had just gotten married 3 months earlier. She said, I don't know if my marriage is going to last. And I said, oh no, that's terrible. But you guys were living together for 2 years. You were dating for so long. You know each other so well. What did you discover in the last 3 months that you didn't see for the whole 2 years that you knew this guy before you got married? And I'll never forget what she said to me. And I'll tell, honestly, to this day, I really can't completely fathom it. But what she said to me was, I just don't know if he's intellectual enough for me. Now, when I was from dating, after I became from, I could usually surmise if the guy was intellectual enough for me, like within the first 20 minutes. You know what I mean? How did she make it for 2 years? Not seeing this, I swear I can't understand it. To this day, I can't understand it. But here's the only explanation I have that makes sense to me. They were very physically involved from very early on in their relationship. They didn't have much time just to get to know each other on a purely intellectual level, shall we say. And from the moment that a man and a woman become physically involved, it's like this rose-colored screen comes down between them, and the screen filters things. It kind of lets through all the positive stuff, it holds back the negative stuff. You see what you want to see, you don't see what you don't want to see. And the problem is that after you get married, the screen lifts. Sometimes if you're perceptive, you can see it already during Sheva Brachas. Like see the last Sheva Bracha. You can already see on the faces of the Chatan and Kala that they start to see things about each other they hadn't seen before. They don't look like they're quite on cloud nine already. Like they're kind of coming down to reality. Usually it takes a few weeks or even a couple of months or more. But, you know, there's an expression that you don't really ever know someone until you're married to them. It's very true. But you can come this close to knowing them, or you can be this far away from knowing them, but you don't really ever know them until you're married to them. A lot of people today are getting married to somebody who they honestly have not seen clearly since early on in their relationship, if ever. Maybe the first few hours, the first few dates. And in that state of blindedness, with that rose-colored screen down there, and seeing what you want to see, that's the state in which they make the decision to marry, and that's the state in which they walk to the chuppah. Now when you think about it, it really should be kind of frightening. Because this is a pretty important decision. You know, like after, like, I want to be alive and I want to be Jewish. I think, like, who do I want to marry is probably number three. You know what I mean? And a friend of mine who lives in Manhattan and had kind of connections with the whole scene up there, I don't know if you're familiar with the Upper West Side in Manhattan or what you've heard about it. You know how the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah? So Rabbi Riskin, who used to be the rabbi, said that his congregants, he calls them the 612ers. And among these 612ers, my friend says she knew no fewer than 10 young couples who got married and divorced within 6 months. I think people just realized after the chuppah that they'd made a terrible mistake. And you know, it's not something you want to have to go through, it's not necessary. As a divorced man once told me, and I'm not judging anybody, you know, we're all good people trying to do our best in a crazy world. But as a divorced man once told me, you know, if you get the wrong job, you can change your job. If you get the wrong car, you can change your car. Very painful to change your spouse. So I remember thinking about this and digesting this understanding about how quickly we can give up our clarity and how easily. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, if the price I have to pay, and I had no intention of becoming Shaman Nagia for a while, obviously, but I said, if the price I have to pay to make sure that I'm marrying the right guy is not getting physical with him, like maybe that price is worth paying. So I can have a good physical relationship with the right person for the next 50 years, God willing, instead of having a blow over my face after 6 months. So I just want to throw that idea out to you. I think it's a kind of frightening idea. But more than the loss of objectivity, what really concerns me when I see couples dating today is a huge misconception about what love is. Love has become an incredibly abused word. It's being thrown around left and right. And I don't know about you, but I kind of feel like if someone ever says to me, I mean, he has obviously, but putting myself back at, you know, before I got married, if somebody ever said to me, I love you, I'd want pretty much to be sure that he meant it, or at least to know what he was meaning when he said that. You know what I mean? Because it means different things to different people. So I apologize for taking the story out of my book. If any of you have read my book, The Magic Touch, I mean, this is the only thing hopefully I'll repeat from the book. It just illustrates the point so well. A rabbi I know was once speaking to some students about love in Judaism. And he said, I love chicken. My wife makes amazing chicken. It's so tasty, I just can't wait to eat it. Boy, do I love chicken. But does that mean that I love the chicken? No, if I loved the chicken, I wouldn't, like, you know, cut his throat and stick it on my plate for dinner. I'd be a vegetarian. And I'd build that chicken a house in the backyard, and I'd sing it lullabies at bedtime, and I'd crochet its sweaters for the winter. And this is my favorite imagery. You know those slings that we have babies in? I'd buy a chicken sling so I could wear my chicken close to me at all times, feed it organic chicken food, you know. That's called loving the chicken. So what am I saying when I say I love chicken? I'm saying I love the way I feel when I eat chicken. Eating chicken gives me pleasure. Who's the focus on over here? Mm-hmm. Me. Who am I really in love with? Myself. This is what's called selfish love. Self-centered, narcissistic love. I love the way I feel when I'm with you. So then this rabbi turned to a girl sitting in the front row and he said, now tell me something. When a guy says to you, I love you, Which kind of love is he talking about? Good question. I'm not into male bashing. You know, when the rabbi asks us, the girl in the back of the room goes, you know, he loves chicken. I'm not into male bashing. I really like men a lot, and I have a lot of respect for them. And at least since I became religious, I think actually religious men are one of the best advertisements for Judaism. A guy who can restrain himself, his natural desires for the sake of something more, respect a woman. Every summer in Jerusalem, they have these Jerusalem fellowships programs that are like co-ed, and they have male and female single madrichim and madrichot in the program. Every summer, all the girls develop huge crushes on the male madrichim because they've never been treated so respectfully before. I have tremendous respect for men. Nevertheless, I believe that a man can look into a woman's eyes, or a boy into a girl's eyes, and say, I love you, and mean it with all his heart. And what he's really saying is, I love chicken. Boy, do I love the way I feel when we're together. Boy, do I get pleasure from you. This reminds me a little bit, actually, about a guy who asked me out when I was in high school. I was in 11th grade and he was in 12th. And he didn't even know me. And the only thing he probably knew about me is I was Jewish, because I remember that he was smiling at me when we both came in after Rosh Hashanah with our notes explaining why we weren't in school. I think I stayed home and watched soap operas, actually. But anyway, he asked me out. I was very surprised. I said, okay. And he said, you want to go horseback riding? And I said, I thought to myself, where did he get the idea that I am into horses? And I said, I'm actually kind of scared of horses. And he goes, oh, I could see his face fell. And he tried to think of something else we could do. We ended up going bowling. And when I look back on that, I think, what was this thing about horseback riding? Like, he didn't even know me. Like, usually, if you're into somebody else, you suggest doing something you know that they would like. What was this horseback riding thing? And I'm scared of horses. And I realize now he wasn't really interested in me. He had a romantic fantasy of going horseback riding with some girls, galloping across a field with their hair blowing in the wind, you know? But it didn't have to be me or my hair. Like, I was interchangeable. He could have plugged anyone into his fantasy. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's called being in love with love. Being in love with love means I'm in love with myself. I'm in love with the feeling, and you conveniently are generating that feeling for me. Thank you. If not you, then somebody else. So that's not love. It's not loving somebody else. Do you know who really, really, I think, said I love you in the most profound way imaginable? Christopher Reeve's wife. Do you remember Christopher Reeve? Mm-hmm. The actor who played Superman? Mm-hmm. Handsome man. I also played in my mother's favorite movie of all time, Somewhere in Time. Romantic movie. I haven't seen it, probably wouldn't do me good to see it, actually. But anyway, handsome man. These things that carry you off into places in your head, and you have to like get yourself back to earth afterwards, and it's all like, kind of weird. But anyway, handsome man, built, the whole works. In real life, what happened to Christopher Reeve? At age 43, in an equestrian competition, he fell off a horse. And this is really scares me because my sister is a big horsewoman. Got a spinal injury and became what's called a vent dependent quadriplegic. Meaning, paralyzed from the neck down and unable to breathe unaided. He needed a ventilator to pump air in and out of his lungs. Horrible, tragic accident for a man who is like fit and active and, you know, I mean, it would be hard enough for a computer geek, but for a guy who was so built and working out and to suddenly just lose your body. And when this horrible, tragic accident happened, he said to his wife, look at me. I can't move anything from the neck down. You're going to have to spend your whole life caring for me. You're going to have to feed me. You're going to have to dress me in the morning, undress me at night. You're going to have to wash me. You're going to have to take me to the bathroom and wipe me for all I know. You're going to have to wheel me from doctor's appointment to doctor's appointment. You're going to be totally waiting on me, taking care of all my needs, and you're going to get nothing in return. I can't even hold your hand. This is not a life for you, he said. Please do yourself a favor and divorce me and marry someone with whom you can have a normal relationship. Now, I want to tell you something. When I first heard this, I thought, oh, come on. like, who, after being married for 10 or 15 years, and was 43, so 50, been married a while, who, what kind of a horrible person would divorce their husband because he became a quadriplegic? What I didn't know, and I only discovered after I read a book that he wrote, was